Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table today. I've got a guest from Gippsland that some of you may well know and others may not. Zeke Bennett, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Scott. How are you going?
Very well, thanks. Very well. Probably hard to describe to the listeners your life, and we're going to dig through that a little bit. But we got to know each other through the Gen Angus program. Probably, was it maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Zeke? Is that right?
Yes, 3 years ago. But I've been back to do things for like the last four. Yeah.
Be careful when you put your hand up as a volunteer at Angus Australia. You get used. And we're very thankful that you've been coming back and helping other cohorts. But yeah, so that's where we got to know each other. And Zeke, for the Angus listeners, and you've got a couple of parts to your business life as well. But let's just quickly give people a snapshot of your Angus stud in Victoria, Zeke.
Yeah. So I purchased my farm a bit over 5 years ago. I'm from a farming family that just do commercial, usually F1 cows, and they breed Veelers. They run about 120 breeders. And I've always been completely obsessed with cows and just farming and agriculture, but specifically cows. I love them. And I always wanted to do it by myself because I never really had the option to go in with my parents. So yeah, I purchased my first bit of ground about 5.5 years ago. And then I bought my first stud herd. When I first got into it, because I hadn't been exposed to breeding stud animals, I definitely made a lot of mistakes, they weren't mistakes. They were definitely good learnings. It's just developed from there. Now I've got about 120, we're breeding about 120 calves a year. We're also doing an embryo program as well. So running around 100 cows and calves and embryos as well. And yeah, it's just been amazing. I had no experience in selling bulls. So the first year, I think I sold 9, and it's been growing from there to the point where selling around 30 a year. And at first I was heavily relying on agents, and now I'm kind of selling them independently. I'd say probably 85% are being sold independently. It's been a dream come true.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Zeke, if you zoom out, we've got the map of Australia. A lot of our listeners are right across the country in New Zealand. So you're east of Melbourne. Just give people an idea of your geography. You're in God's country down there in Gippsland, aren't you?
Yeah. So I'm about an hour and 45 minutes from Melbourne, based in Shady Creek, which is kind of near Warragul in Gippsland. Warragul is one of the largest towns around here. And I'm kind of up on the hill. So our property is a combination of river flats and hill country. Got a pretty high rainfall up here and pretty fertile soils as well. So it's good. I guess one of the only challenges is that price per acre, it is very expensive. It's really quite hard to get into farming if you're looking to purchase down in Gippsland.
And what sort of soils are you on there, Zeke?
Loam. So the river flats, so on the hills, it kind of varies. I do actually have a sand pit on my farm, and in certain areas of Shady Creek, there are other sand pits as well. So it really does vary from paddock to paddock. There's also quite a lot of bush as well. But down on the flats, you'd have a meter of topsoil down there. And the boundary of my property is about 1.5K of creek. So it has its pros and cons. It will flood down there, but during the summer period, you can kind of have green grass there all year round, which is also amazing. And that's one thing that after learning everything over the last 5 years, I'm starting to putting crops to silage this year and just really utilize those flats over the summer and then utilize the hills over the winter. So yeah.
Okay. No, that's great. Everybody's got a different view of what's the high rainfall. How many millimeters of rain would you, what would you average there in that part of the world? Like
So you get 1,000 to 1,200 a year, I believe. It does vary, but usually you'll get 1,000 mil down here.
okay, so that's pretty productive country. And how many hectares are you running those? Basically 100, 120 breeders. What's how many hectares would it take to run those there? See?
So my farm is 140 acres, ideally in acres, not hectares. But my farm is 140 acres, and then I have a couple of other lease properties as well. I lost one at the start of the year, which was 140 acres, and then there's two others of 50 and 70 as well. But I've also started to, because I have to travel for work as well, I've really been working on efficiencies and getting so that I'm not solely reliant on pasture. So I'm starting to get good quality hay feeders in each paddock where if I am going away, I can start to put some cereal hay, which I've started doing this year, and also just pasture hay and silage so that it can kind of get them through and get me longer through a paddock in winter and also potentially summer.
Okay, no, that's interesting. Now, like, that's an overview of your Angus operation. Now, it's not all you do, Zeke, and that's one of the interesting parts why I've grabbed you for the podcast today. You run a very successful landscaping business in Sydney, if I'm not mistaken. Do you want to just give the listeners a bit of an overview of that one?
Okay, cool. So I have owned the company's called Maintain Me. I've owned it for, I think it's 12 years now. It's 11 or 12 years. It's been a long time. Bit of a step back. So I finished school, high school dropout. I'd kind of worked, my parents grew hydroponic tomatoes. So from the age of five, I've always worked. I had to work in the greenhouse, and we used to sell all of our produce at farmers markets. From selling produce at farmers markets, I realized I never wanted to get a normal job. So I actually started up a poultry farm. I seen a bloke selling eggs at a farmers market when I was 12, and I've always liked chooks. So we had an old shearing shed on the farm, and I convinced my parents to let me buy some Isa Browns and start selling the eggs at farmers markets with the tomatoes. Anyways, I think by 14, I had around 3,000 free range laying hens, and I was obviously still at school at this time as well. So, and I was a national swimmer as well. So, and I'll say one other thing: I'm quite hyperactive, so I always have to be doing something. So I used to go to swimming in the morning, anywhere from 8 to 10 times a week, to burn off the steam. And then I'd come home, do the chooks, go to school, come back home, and do the chooks again. So, anyways, by the time I turned 18, I'd pretty much burnt myself out from working in the greenhouse and doing the chooks. So I ended up joining the circus, and then I was an acrobat for a period of time. Had an injury. I actually fell off a trapeze in Bali. Well, I didn't actually fall. The trapeze fell down when I was on it, and I had a back injury. So I had to come back to Australia for medical reasons. And then I went up to Sydney just to see a friend that I'd met from being in the circus. And being in Gippsland, it's amazing in the spring and the summer, but in winter, it is very wet and quite gloomy. And I went to Sydney for the first time, and it was just sunny, and it was so nice. So I ended up staying up there, got a job in banking as a receptionist. And I was just like, I can't do this. You were being dressed in a suit, and like it was very regimented. You had to be there from like 7 till 3. And that didn't really. It wasn't really my thing, but I thought, what can I do to earn some extra money when I'm here? And being in the greenhouse, I had a lot of horticultural skills, and I also used to do gardening with my grandmas. So I started mowing lawns on the weekend to make some extra money, to the point where then I quit my job and started mowing lawns full time. And that's how Maintain Me started. It also started by taking on horrible labouring work that no one else would want to do in like eastern suburbs in Sydney. So they're very steep properties, and sometimes you'd just be carrying rocks for 10 to 12 hours for $30 an hour. Like it was hard, but I also liked fitness, so it was a good form of exercise.
And it kicked off, and you had quite an interesting growth, didn't you? So walk us through to what it looks like today. And then we might dig into a little bit about how you did that.
So pretty much after stopping the banking, within a year, pretty booked out with work. And because I'd never actually worked in another landscaping company or gardening company, I guess developed a way to garden, and people really liked it. And it was a lot, like a lot of our customers said, oh, it's a lot different. So what we done was implement systems and processes so that it could be expanded. And also at this time I did have a business partner. So we started it together. However, now I own and run Maintain Me by myself. And I run it solely for the last 8 years by myself. But yeah, just implemented systems and processes so that if it wasn't me doing the actual work, I could train someone to do the same thing and make sure that there was consistency across every single appointment. And yeah, I think that took probably around 4 years to develop systems and processes and make it quite what I thought at the time was bulletproof as well. I will go back a little bit. A couple of other things that was done from day one of having our first employee, we had an employment lawyer because I had no experience in employing people, literally had no idea what I was doing. So that was really good just to make sure that from the get-go, before you actually grew all of those systems and making sure that it was a legal business to run as well. So I would say that that was definitely beneficial. One other thing, when we were creating the systems and processes, I wanted to be able to create a business where people could go book online, book a gardener. They'll show up at a particular time and they can pay online as well. So that was implemented 10 years ago. And yeah, I think that we're still like the only garden maintenance company in Sydney who is doing that. And that's, I would say, a pretty big thing because a lot of people in the trades industry always want the tradie to come out and give a quote. And like that's usually minimum an hour of time, then going home and writing up the quote. And what needed to be done was to create a website where people could get the confidence and also all that information right there without even having a verbal conversation with you for them to put their credit card details into the website and book that appointment. People can still also call as well. So you have a 1300 number. But yeah, that was a bit of a game changer, especially in COVID as well, when like you couldn't go out in quote. So yeah, that's pretty much a nutshell of how it started.
Interesting. And how many staff do you employ now, Zeke, in your landscape business?
Between 18 and 20 full-time staff. However, probably about 3 years ago, there was over 28, and that was just too
Oh,
much.
yeah.
So what I've decided to do was make it smaller, just focus on quality and not have too many people to manage.
What I find interesting, Zeke, and when I first met you, it's quite extraordinary that that's quite a growth in scale with regards to how do you implement systems in probably an industry that struggled with systems and approaches to marketing. That's extraordinary growth, isn't it? That's a lot of people, and also someone who manages a lot of people, takes a lot to make sure that those customers are happy. And that they're getting paid without mistakes, that are not costing you money. So it's an amazing growth in a business. How did you must have been hard working on the tools and creating the systems. And I think that's what's difficult for a lot of small businesses, how to scale without losing the profitability on the way. How did you go about developing those systems, see?
It was, so for starters, you're absolutely right. It was extremely difficult. And I will say one thing. It's good that I was young. You kind of get these ideas and then you start and you're kind of working towards that end goal of what this could be. But if someone said, this is what it's going to be like, and it's going to take you 4 years to do this, and it could cost you over $200,000 in development, you'd be like, oh, is this really something that I want to do? So there's definitely a bit of being naive there, and also not setting up a business before, not kind of seeing what other people were doing. So I would say one of the best things is not necessarily knowing how other people are doing it. So all you have to model off is what you think is best and is going to be best for the customer. So that was definitely one thing. How do you go to set up systems? So pretty much it is a process. And I would say that it takes years. So come up with an idea and start to work through them. And you might implement one system that you think is great, but then when you have staff going to try and use that, you realize pretty quickly, okay, on paper this works, but in reality, this isn't actually working. And you need to be willing to keep on changing things, to keep on making them better so that it's kind of bulletproof. So there was a lot of trial and error. One other thing, like the systems were kind of based off me as well, because if I'm a bit hyperactive, I'm kind of all over the place. If they can sustain me, they can sustain 99.9% of people.
Interesting.
So yeah, but just a lot of trial and error, and also not settling. One thing that I've kind of learned in life is that something might not be possible and someone might not have done something now, but that doesn't mean that it's not possible. And you see that in a lot of, with scientists and everything, how they say you can't do something, but now you can do it. And it's incredible. So I hope that answers it.
Yeah. So Zeke, you, to put it in perspective for the listeners, you're not in Sydney very often.
Yeah.
You're essentially running your Gippsland Angus operation.
Yeah.
And that's where you primarily reside. But you've got 20 people on the tools in another capital city, in another state.
In the CBD as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm sure anyone listening would understand the complexity with regards to that. So you're not there teaching them how to do the day-to-day tasks. So how did you create the system to be able to then replicate the system? So how does that work? Because it's quite extraordinary, to be honest.
Yeah. So the system was, I would say, 80% created when I lived in Sydney, because obviously I lived there. It wasn't up until 5 years ago that I moved down. So there was already a base system. And when I was there, I was doing all the training. I was in the warehouse from 4 till, I don't know, 9 o'clock every single day. I was the first one there and the last one home. One interesting thing is that when it was created, like, we have a warehouse in Sydney now, but we didn't always have that. The business was created out of my Commodore with Victorian number plates on it. Had to move out to Bankstown, live in a friend's garage, which was completely freezing, just to save money to keep on investing. Then managed to move into the city because most of our customers were in the city, and the travel, you'd be traveling for like 2 to 3 hours every single day in traffic. And so managed to move into the city. Then when we started to grow, started to rent lock-up garages in apartment complexes out of the CBD, which had no reception downstairs. So that's kind of how the systems and processes started, trying to create something where there was no reception. And I think we got to the point where there was 12 full-time staff coming 7 o'clock in the morning down into these garages and then driving up in the company vans. And it was good while it lasted, but it just wasn't sustainable. So I made the jump to go into the warehouse. But yeah, pretty much when we got that warehouse, it gave you a lot of space. It was a lot more expensive as well. It was probably the biggest expense because it is literally 1 kilometer from the CBD as well. So
Oh, wow.
we
Right.
operate just by the Sydney Fish Market.
So
And
that's expensive real estate,
you're looking at,
top right
so
front.
you're looking at over $100,000 a year just in rent, just for the building. And it's not the best one, but it is what it is, and it does the job. But yeah, so I was in the warehouse. We've been fortunate to have staff that have been with us for a long period of time, some 8, 9 years. And over time, you start to give them more responsibilities. A lot of these staff worked with me when I was on the tools as well. So I was able to train them directly. Obviously, when they start training the next generation, you do lose a bit of quality, and they do start kind of doing things different than what it was initially intended. But you can't get too upset about that, because you can only control what you can control. And there was a point where I tried to control everything across like 28 staff, and it's just too much. Like you can't do that. So you need to let people be responsible and make their own decisions, but give them that framework. And now, kind of back to your story about how do you manage people interstate and only going back on like a 4 weekly basis. It's because I was there. Like I started it. I lived it. I was in it for hours. I just done it 7 days a week. In all my spare time, I was literally working. I never had a day off. And then when I started to move down here, I would still go to Sydney for 5 days a week. So I'd fly down first flight on Monday, I'd fly back last flight on a Friday, and then I'd do farm work on the weekend, and then I'd go back again, and I would do that. And it's not just as easy as kind of being like, this is the new chapter, I'm just going to drop it. You definitely need to put the time and put in the legwork to make sure that things are good. But that's how it happened. And then I started to go down to 4 days and 3 days and 2 days. And then I started to push it out even more because the farm started to get more busy. And I really do have a passion for it. So the farm is, and the cattle is, my happy space. And that's how I was able to kind of make that transition. But it wasn't like just buy the farm and then, all right, I'm off, I'm not coming back. It was quite a few years of doing that.
And
And
Zeke,
one other thing, I was always available. So I lived on my phone. Like people would call you all the time, and you just kind of need to make sure that you're available for that.
interesting.
Yeah.
Now, Zeke, 20 people on the tools, you're living in a state, those people got to have work every day. Tell us about the sales pipeline. How does that work for you? And I'm told you're a master of social media and good techniques in that way. But obviously, word of mouth is good to an extent, isn't it? But you can't run 20 people and keep them at capacity just by that. Tell us a bit, how do you run your back end sales now?
Yeah. So I guess if you look at the company and the types of jobs that we have, 70% would be residential work. And a lot of that is also repeat people on some type of a repeat appointment, which could be weekly, 2 weekly, 4 weekly, 6 monthly. Like they all vary. Then we have commercial, where they're usually a larger contract with lesser profits but more reliability. And then you've also got the landscaping work, which is where you design a garden or design improvements, and then you have the landscaping team implement that as well. In regards to sales pipeline, we spend a lot of money on SEO and kind of getting our brand up on Google, which 10 years ago was the only way to search. It's completely changed now, and we don't use social media in the business to advertise the business. So, although what I've done on the farm, I had no experience in that in the landscaping company.
So,
A
what
lot
are
of
some of those techniques that you use to primarily you're generating those leads? Well, one word of mouth, but two from your website. What are
Yeah,
some of
so
the
obviously
techniques?
being online, also sending out sales. One thing that I've learned is that people hate to be sold. So I've learned that in the landscaping, and I don't do that on the farm as well. If something isn't right, you can't try and push someone into a sale or try and push an appointment, because they're usually the people that complain or they're the people that aren't happy. So I try to lead by doing solutions-based selling. We still get a lot of work from Google at the moment, also existing customers, word of mouth, but then also just talking to customers. Like, a lot of time people might want improvements. Like, we have over 1,000 customers on our books now. It would actually be more, probably around 1,300 to 1,400 people that we've either done appointments for or work for and whatnot. So you can kind of also look through past appointments and send emails to see if they need something. Also making a lot of recommendations. In Sydney, and especially in the eastern suburbs and whatnot, a lot of people don't just want someone to come and mow their lawn or hedge their hedges. They want people to make recommendations. So we're really big on making recommendations and getting additional work. Our guys also, you have a lot of people walking down the street, and all of our vans are branded as well. And I always tell the boys to make sure that you say hi to everyone who walks past on you, which is very much a country thing to do, but a lot of people don't do that in the city. So always say hi and smile. You'll be surprised at how many people say, "Oh, you're doing some gardening. Oh, I've got a house just down here. Can you have a look at this?" And then it's really that kindness and niceness that does come off, I think, across all parts of our business. And that definitely helps with sales as well. I probably should be looking at social media and also AI to generate more sales leads as well. But I think after developing systems in the sales pipeline for so many years and spending so much money on it, it's something I don't really want to pick up at
Yeah, no,
the
that's fair. That's a
moment.
good point. And I hope that gives the listeners a bit of a sense of really quite a business acumen that you have.
I think that with our business, a lot of people want to know how much stuff's going to cost, because they think tradies is expensive and stuff like that. So we're one of the only companies that put our prices online. Like, you've always been able to see our prices. We have standard prices for everything. Nothing is kind of, "Oh, you'll make an extra $50 here," and stuff like that. Everything has a particular price. And I think that when you're training staff as well, like, they don't necessarily want to be selling. So if there's something set for everything, they can repeat it, because they're just doing their jobs. But if it's their responsibility to be like, "I've got to make as much as possible. I might charge them $100 for this and whatnot," that doesn't, I would say that that could work and you could make money off that, but I don't see how you can grow that. Like, you need to have a system so that it can be scalable. One other thing I will say as well, I still work in the business every day. I wake up first thing, I do all the work orders. There's only one person who sits in the warehouse now who is doing kind of recommendations and smaller design work. Yeah, pretty much. I still work in the business every single day. There's certain things that I don't need to do anymore, but you still have to be across everything. So, and then I try and get down there every kind of 4 to 6 weeks just to check up on things and make sure that everything's going well, if I need to make improvements, and just make the staff know that you're kind of known, and if they need anything as well. One big part of the role is mentoring and also just making sure that everyone's okay.
No, that's a good overview. Now, your business has done well. You've got a love for agriculture and cattle. Your parents are obviously have been involved in Gippsland in that area, and they're farming there. You've got a good background. So then your businesses have been able to help you get into property in Gippsland. A question I've got for you is, and it's great when people come into a sector without all the blinkers on. So you've come in with a fresh set of eyes and a good set of eyes, because you've learned your business lessons from essentially a completely different industry. So,
Yeah.
what did that look like, Zeke? So, first of all, how did you go about buying your first block in Gippsland? But
Yeah.
then, what did you bring from your landscape world, your business world in Sydney, inner city, and how did that help you change your mindset and develop your Angus operation in a different way than most people would approach it?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a broad question. So I purchased the farm. How did I buy it? I done it from obviously earning a wage as well, but I also dabbled in property as well. So I love property. So dabbled in property, saved my money. I've kind of always tried to invest most of my money.
And
So
you're drawn to Gippsland because of the family, because
yeah,
your
it's
mum and dad
just
are in that part of the world.
yeah, there was like the option to potentially like buy in Sydney, but Sydney never felt like home for me. I never planned on living in a city. Like I'm very much a country person. I never really wanted to be there, but I was there, and it kind of like growing the business, and then you stay there. And landscape across Australia in regards to agricultural land is very different. I really only knew farming in Gippsland because I understood the rainfall and how it kind of worked. Well, that's what I thought at the time. I've obviously learned a lot more now. So purchased the first farm, obviously have a mortgage on it as well. It was very, very difficult to purchase it. It took a lot of years because I'd go home and I'd say, yeah, I'm going to buy a farm. And it just wasn't happening. Like it hadn't happened for like 8, 9 years. And definitely stretched myself, had to sell a property, an investment property, and move down. My
And
farm
it's a
also,
pretty expensive part of Australia, dollars per hectare. It's a you know, a dollars per cow unit. It's not one of the cheaper areas, is it, to operate?
So I think average price for farmland in Gippsland now would be around, it really does, it does vary, but 15 to 20 to 25,000 an acre. So it's definitely up there. And the worst thing is, I think before COVID, like it was kind of getting possible. And then COVID just really changed everything because a lot of people from the city moved out and they could go and buy these farms as well. So I pretty much bought a farm that was completely run down, had no fences, had no power, had no water, doesn't have a house, didn't have anything whatsoever. And that's how I was able to do it. And then just been making a lot of improvements over time. But I think your question was, how do you kind of implement the systems and how do you take that learning from the business over? So one thing that I got a bit more comfortable with is spending money because I've always been quite frugal. Like I come from a family that try and make their money go as far as they can. But obviously spending money on landscapes and whatnot, I'd seen, like I had a lot of customers who would speak to me and they'd speak to me about money and I would ask a lot of questions. And instead of thinking it as spending money, I think about it as investing, so saving time. So what can I do to save time? What can I do to make it more manageable? What can I do to make it more safer? What can I do to produce a better animal with what I've got? And that kind of like that's come through from the landscaping company.
Yeah, so you established your property. How did you? What vision did you have at the start when you came in there? You thought, I want to breed Angus cattle, stud cattle, but I'm guessing you had a blank canvas. And yeah, what was your vision then?
So the reason I went into stud, I've always wanted to do it. I remember driving back from Gippsland to Sydney, and I was in the Commodore at that stage as well. I bought the Weekly Times and I seen Tamania and I just seen their black cattle. And it was a Weekly Times article and it just stuck out to me. And I always kind of wanted to do that. Like I would have, like in an ideal world, I guess 30 or well, 25 years before that, I just wanted cows. I just wanted to do cows and calves like my parents. But then when I started thinking about it, I found the genetics quite interesting as well. And that's kind of what led me into stud. I looked at potentially doing stud Hereford or Angus, but one of the reasons I didn't do Hereford is because They get eye cancers. So that's why I didn't do Hereford and I went towards Angus. So I was between them two. And I purchased my first herd, which was a stud, pretty much base APR herd. And I really had not a lot of experience with it. So I bought 45 cows and calves. And then I just realized, oh, well, these EBVs really aren't where I want them to be. And then I started learning more about it, and I realized, you know what, I might have rushed into that a little bit too quick, because when I first seen this herd, they were the best herd I'd ever seen. So I bought them. And then now what I know now, I probably wouldn't have done that. After purchasing that herd, those cows were quite expensive. They were 4,600 a unit. It just completely the market just completely dropped. So they went down to about, I don't know, 1,200. And I was like, oh, if I sell them, I'm going to lose. So I started doing the lease properties as well, because at that point, I had seen Simon Quilty at Gen Angus and I heard his talk and I was like, you know what, I'm going to hang on. And I hung on for like 2 years to those cows, but started breeding up. I bought some other HBR cows and then I started to kind of work with them and work with embryos and whatnot. So that was definitely a learning, a good one. Like, it was an expensive learning, but a good one. And now I try and not think a little bit more, because I don't regret it, because I actually learned a lot off it, and I still made money off it because I didn't sell them. But yeah, does that answer
And you've
your
transitioned,
question?
yeah. So you've transitioned. So you had that initial vision, and then you've transitioned into more of a HPR herd, I guess. What sort of split would you have now?
So have 30 HBR cows and calves and have 20 heifers coming through, and then would still have 50 APR cows and calves. But because I bought base APR, I've been keeping, like, I always keep the females and I've been improving them. So those what were originally base APR cows are, like, genetically I'm improving them and getting them where I want. And there's nothing wrong, like, there's nothing wrong with either of them, but one of the goals was one day to get a bull into a semen catalog, and I thought, right, the best way to do that is HBR.
Okay.
So
All
yeah.
right. And have you had mentors that you've used to develop your skills in breeding? Zeke?
So no. Most of it has been no official mentors. However, from doing Gen Angus, I really didn't have any friends in the industry.
Oh.
But I've met some people through the Gen Angus and also Tocal. I done the judging school with them. I've met some really amazing people, and now I would consider them mentors as well. But from the get-go, not really. I just spoke to my dad about it, who didn't really have any experience specifically in stud, and yeah, it's just kind of gone from there, and just meeting people, talking to people. Also, I started posting on social media just about my farm because I loved it, and then you do quite a lot of networking through that, so you meet people, also customers as well, people who buy your bulls. So yeah, I think that my network has definitely grown, because it was nothing.
Okay. Before we jump into the marketing side, the on the breeding objective side, is it still a one day a vision for you to produce a high merit bull that could be used in an AI setting? And what would be, if you did had to describe your breeding objectives now, what would you describe them as?
So in regards to an EBV perspective, so my main thing is I want quiet bulls, because a lot of my market is mum and dad farmers who want a nice quiet bull who they feel safe about. You can obviously never trust any bull, but docility is my main thing. Obviously, producing animals that aren't going to break down quickly. So you start to look at feet. Feet is very, very important to me. And then also just calving. Like, coming from a farm where we used to have F1 cows, like, at some points we used to do Belgian Blues, Charolais, Limousin. Part of that was pulling calves, and you don't really want to be pulling any calves whatsoever. It obviously happens, but producing bulls where they're quiet, they're sound, they're gonna if you're producing females, they're gonna calve easily unassisted. That's what it's kind of all about for me. And then where I can make improvements to get them heavier and whatnot, I obviously do that as well. But also to go and buy those types of cows with EBVs like that, like they're a lot of money. So you kind of start with a base. Like I managed to buy some really good Ardrossan cows from Rob Buell, and that's what I've been kind of working on. And since then, I've made other purchases and whatnot, but that's my base of my HBR herd.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, an interesting one for me is so you're really green. You've started your Angus stud. You've not got some sort of family legacy with which to sell those bulls. So, what did you wake up one morning, and perhaps this is where you've got a, now a bit of a reputation for your social media. Tell us, how did you go about marketing your stock? No established network. So you would have had a look at it and gone, how do I do this? What happened next?
So one thing that I realized pretty early on is that I needed to be more in control of my sales because my agent was the family agent of 30 years. And like you'd sell cows and like they'd go into market and you'd be expecting, let's just say round figures, like $1,000, and then you'd get $600. And when you're not making any money off the farm, like it took, well, this year I've literally started to make money off it, but I'd just been reinvesting everything for years and spending additional money as well. But like if you think you're getting $1,000, and you kind of spend it in your head beforehand, and then you need to find that money and whatnot. So I really realized that I needed to be in control of my own sales and not be so heavily reliant on agents. One other thing as well is that we're kind of in a dairy area down here, and there are definitely stud farms around here, breeding stud beef, but a lot of those breeders might have been doing it for 50 years. So you're competing with them who could be selling 50, 100, 150 bulls a year, and you've got literally eight bulls. It's very hard to be taken serious as well. So I started posting on social media. I probably can't articulate exactly why I started doing it, but in my head, I bought my first herd of cows, which I loved, which are the ones which were the base APR cows. And I just wanted to show people my cows. And I kind of wanted people to, although I didn't really know anyone and I was very green to it, I wanted people to think that, you know what, he kind of does know what he's doing to an extent. So I posted everything. I posted all the good, all the bad, fencing, soil improvement, fertilizing, nothing's filtered. So I never go out and plan a video. I literally have my phone out and I just film what's going on. If I can make it into a video, I do. Nothing scripted. You never do multiple takes. It's just one take. It is whatever comes out of your mouth. That's what it is. And I feel like just because of the regularity of posting and also people seeing kind of how hard you actually work on so many different projects and whatnot, I feel like indirectly it's kind of been beneficial for me because people can see like how much I actually do care. I never claim to be an expert, but how hard I do try. And I think that that definitely comes across. And like I remember speaking to people, like a specific friend who was has been in the breed for a long time, one that I met through Gen Angus, and he said to me, it's gonna like people don't think to go to TikTok to buy a bull or to see bulls and whatnot. But I've also never tried to sell any of them. So at no point have I ever been like, this is a bull, this is a sale. I've never ever said what is the sale. I just show people what I'm doing. If I sell a bull, I say, oh yeah, I sold him. He's going to X. But I never want to sell people. But I think by doing that and people regularly seeing your animals in good, bad, kind of every stage, it paints a picture. And then they message you, and because you get a lot of messages and whatnot. And yeah, I feel like that's literally how it's worked. It's never been intentional. But now I am actually making sales off it and making sales from different states as well. Like I have people who write to me from, like, my client base has always just been Gippsland, but people write to me who might see what you're doing online and they're like, you know what, I actually want that from different states. So that's been really humbling. So I think that, you could maybe describe it as like it's definitely not direct selling or anything like that. I don't know what the right word for it is, but that's pretty much how it's happened.
And would that be the main source of your interested clients? Is it coming in from those sort of mediums rather than
I think
traditional ones?
because I've been selling bulls for 4 years now, obviously word of mouth as well. Certain agents kind of start to take you maybe a little bit more serious now. Yeah, so other customers, but yeah, also social media, also just branding as well, like getting a sign for the front of your property. I don't think that there is one method to marketing a business or a product. I think it's all those little 5%ers and 10%ers that kind of add up to something. And I'm definitely not where I want to be. I've got so much more work that I want to do on it to kind of increase those sales and whatnot. But yeah.
There's a big part of that is your authentic story, isn't there? I think you, before somebody picks up the phone and says, "Okay, can I come and look at a bull?" They feel like they know you, I guess. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that is true. People do think that they like you get stopped in the street, people come and talk to you and whatnot.
Oh.
There is this is actually a little bit concerning, but there are that many fake profiles online across multiple different social media networks that steal my content. I
Oh,
only
really?
yeah, so at the moment, this is probably the most concerning one because it's probably good that I'm on the Angus podcast. There is AI images of me, like they're pretty much making up OnlyFans accounts using AI and my
Wow.
videos and whatnot. And people are paying money for this, like they're actually getting subscribers and whatnot, and they get shut down. But there's nothing that you can really do about it. Some
Yeah.
Facebook pages have over 50,000 followers. Like one goes down, the next one goes up. So
Yeah, okay.
that's not me. I've never been like that. I'm not going to be like that. But yeah, that's one of the downsides
One thing that's fascinating to me.
to
One thing I wanted to draw out with you, Zeke, is sometimes a lot of our members would feel that they don't know how to go about social media. They don't know how to go about their marketing, and therefore they might feel they need to pay for an industry professional that knows that sort of thing to manage it, which is good, and those people do a great job. But what would you say to a family that are trying to market themselves? You're basically you're pretty self-taught in that. You probably got a fair head start from your business in Sydney, but that authenticity seems to come from you doing it and having a go when it works or it doesn't work. What would you say to us, somebody that was trying to work it out and navigate the social media world?
I would say like so a couple of things. I don't like the way that I don't like the way that I speak at all. So that's definitely an insecurity of mine. However, you make a couple of videos or you do a couple of posts and then you just get over it. So I would say just do it. Like just be yourself. There's no one better to market your brand. Like you could go and pay someone tens of thousands of dollars and like because I've done that in another company before, but there's no one better to market your own products than yourself. Because one thing that I know about farmers is that they love their animals and they love talking about them. I've never met a farmer that doesn't like talking about cows. So, especially if you're in the stud game as well. So, just get out and show people what you're doing. Talk about it. Who cares? Like, at the end of the day, if I actually cared what people like think or perceive me, like I know that with all the good, there's also a lot of bad as well. Like a lot of people might think, oh, he inherited it or he comes from a rich family or anything like that. None of that's obviously the case. You can only control so much. But I would say that there's no one better to advertise yourself or your products than yourself. So just get online and do it. Don't read the comments. I don't read the comments and I don't actually reply to them either. And people say, like, they're like, well, how, like, you could be missing sales. And I say, if people want to get in touch with me, you can always, like, just just Google Zeal Angus. You can find a phone number to me and you can give me a call. You can write me an inbox as well. I'll always open up inboxes from people who I think is legit, because you get a lot of other funny ones as well. But I always have time for farmers to talk to them. I always talk to other farmers. I always try and help people as well. Like, especially a lot of young people, like they'll write to you and say, I want to get into it, or like, what do? I try and give people the information that I wish I knew when I started, which I didn't have.
No, I think it's a pretty unique approach, Zeke. I think it's very encouraging to people that.
One other thing about social media is it is free. It is completely free. You can post on numerous different networks for free for a lot of people to see as well. So that's one of the best things about it, because you can go, like, I've experimented with radio, looked into TV, newspaper, Google SEO, AdWords, all these cold calling as well, all these different things in the landscaping company as well. They all have a price to them, and marketing is so expensive. I'm not saying don't do it. Like in an ideal world, you should be doing multiple different things. But if you maybe don't have the budget and you just want to start to experiment and whatnot, get on social media. And you know what? If you do it for 3 months and you're like, I don't like this, don't do it. That's pretty
That's
much
great.
it.
That's
So.
great. I think there's some really good tips that people, other members could take away, Zeke. And interestingly, it doesn't compete with you. It's telling their story so that they can market their Angus cattle, whether it's seed stock or commercial. So look, thanks for really, really sharing that.
One thing that I don't necessarily do, and it kind of goes back to people thinking that you're a wanker and whatnot, I don't really tell people about my landscaping company. So I've never said it online or anything like that. I kind of keep it separate. It's not a secret, but it's just something that I don't openly kind of necessarily advertise.
No, I think but it's certainly just given you a wealth of experiences in the business world and how to operate, how to create a good business with good strong systems and how to market yourself. And no, I think it's very commendable, and we really appreciate you sharing some of those insights.
Thank you.
Mate, values, what are you yeah the way you operate, what do you hold dear? To whether it's landscaping, whether it's Angus cattle, the way you do life, what are some of your personal values?
Hard work. I come from a working family, and it's bred into you. Like, I don't really know how to have a day off. I don't necessarily know how to. That's definitely something that was bred into me. Treating other people the way that you want to be treated as well. That's like, I'm actually a big softie, and I feel for animals and people and whatnot. So I always try to be kind. One other thing is I think that you need to stand up for yourself as well. Like, you need to have your own back, because one thing that I've learned in life is that if people can, they'll like. I don't think it's people's fundamentals, like guiding principles or anything, but you need to have your own back. You need to look after yourself. You need to stand up for yourself as well, because people will try and walk over you, even if they don't know that they're doing it. And honesty as well. So obviously, just living an honest life, I can go to bed at night knowing, which is actually a really nice feeling, but knowing that I'm actually a good person, that I'm a kind person, an honest person as well. There's definitely something in that, I would say.
Something reassuring in your soul. That's really great, mate. No, they're pretty good values to hold on to. But where would you're talking to someone else in business? Do you have some places to send people, either good books or resources, podcasts? Can some of our members get some of your thinking, mate?
So one thing that I didn't necessarily know at the time, but obviously when I first moved to Sydney, we had a lot of wealthy customers, and I just spoke to people. Like, I asked them,
Oh.
questions, and people think you can't do that, but it's not from a nosy kind of prying perspective. It's more so from an interest. So if you're interested about something and someone is doing it, talk to them about it. Like it's as simple as that. Because one thing that I really realized is that a lot of people are willing to help you, and a lot of people are willing to talk to you as well, especially if you have an interest in whatever they might be doing or whatnot. So that would probably be one of my best things, speak to people. In saying that, you do need to be careful what you like. If you have ideas, sometimes you shouldn't necessarily tell everyone your ideas, and if you're potentially working towards something, because sometimes people can't comprehend that it could be done or that you could even do that, because they might have a they might have an image of you, and because you might not have done it before. But yeah, I would definitely say that that's definitely a big one. And if you do tell people, if people don't like your idea, who cares? Like you're the one who's doing it. You're the one who's going to be waking up at 4, 3, 4, 5 o'clock to do it and working through the night. So you can tell people, but take on the stuff that you want to take on. In regards to books, I used to do quite a lot of reading. All my books are just on money, property, and kind of motivation as well. One book which is a really easy read would be Rich Dad Poor Dad. I really like that. It's a
Oh, yeah. Yep.
super easy read, but just gives you a different idea about money.
I remember reading Rich Dad Poor Dad as a younger guy, and Cashflow Quadrant. There was a whole set of Kiyosaki's books which were pretty good reading, and still good reading today.
Another good one which I liked was Start With Why, which is by Simon Sinek.
Great read.
Yeah, so I liked that one.
No, that's some good titles we haven't had before. So,
Yeah.
no, well done, Zeke. No, that's great. And mate, very important question. What's your best beef eating experience, Zeke?
Yep. So my best beef eating experience was when I was 19. Bit of a story to this. My mum and my dad, so I come from like a carnivore house. Like they eat them.
Yeah.
You literally, you'll have a barbecue, there's 90% meat, 10% salad, all the
That's
meats.
great.
Except my mum, she worked a lot. She was always quite time poor, and she'd be doing multiple things when she was cooking. So she was kind of a set and forget cook. So she used to cook these steaks for 30 minutes, and they were so tough. And like the only way I'd ever had it was burnt or very, very well cooked. And I was sitting
Yep.
next to a girl once, and she ordered a medium rare steak with mushroom gravy just from a pub. And I'd been drinking, and I thought, I'll just have that. And when the first time I had a medium rare steak where you could actually taste it, it wasn't even a good steak, but that was the best steak I had ever had. And now I always have them rare. I eat steak probably 5 times a week. And yeah, so that was my sitting at just a small country pub, the first time I had a medium rare steak with mushroom gravy.
Fantastic. That's great, Zeke. That's excellent. Look,
So
Zeke, we really appreciate having you on the Angus table today. You've got a really different story than although what I have learned is everyone's story is just as unique as the next one. But we thank you for just sharing your business insights, your vision, how you've built what you've got together. I've always been impressed, and I love chatting to you when we get to spend a bit of time together. I've been to the farm. I think you're doing great work there, and I can't wait to watch the future evolve, Zeke.
thank you.
So.
I really appreciate it. And thanks for all the support. Like Angus Australia has always been so good to me. I remember doing Gen Angus for the first year, and I felt it was such an amazing, amazing course. And that's where I met you the first time. But it was just such an amazing course. And I really didn't want it to end. And I felt sad because I was like, oh, I'm never going to get to experience something like that again. And then for the last 4 years, I've been able to be asked back and go and do things and network. And yeah, it just really is such a great program. Like anyone who is listening, who's thinking of applying, you got to apply. Like honestly, like it's changed my life and my view, and it's definitely helped me. But yeah, just the Angus community as well, the people that you can meet. I feel very grateful to be able to be asked back and share my story and hopefully inspire. And you guys have done that so for me. So thank you so much.
Oh no, thanks, Zeke, and thanks for your words. And Zeke, thanks again for being on the Angus Table podcast today. I'm sure this will be one of those great episodes that people will love to listen to. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And if anyone ever wants to reach out who's in the industry or just wants to chat and whatnot, you can find me.
It's very kind of you, Zeke.
Cool.
All right. Have a great day,
Thank you.
everyone.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.